The following podcast contains explicit language. Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, June 3rd, the Quiet as a Mouse edition. I'm Jamila Lemieux, a writer, contributor to Slate's Care and Feeding parenting column, and mom to Naima, who is 8, and we live in L.A.
I'm Elizabeth Newcamp. I write the homeschool and family travel blog Dutch Dutch Goose. I'm the mom to three littles, Henry, who's 9, Oliver, who's 7, and Teddy, who's 4, and we live in Colorado Springs.
And I am Isaac Butler. I am a writer and the co-host of Slate's Working podcast, the father of Iris, age 6, and we all live in Brooklyn, New York.
Thank you for joining us again, Isaac. It's always great to have you on the show.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Today, we're going to be counseling a family who's got new downstairs neighbors. And not even 24 hours after moving in, these new neighbors have already sent a potentially passive-aggressive note about their little boy's noise level. What to do, what to do. Then we'll be answering a question about a little girl who wants to quit soccer. Her parents have her sitting on the bench for a few games, but is that the best way to teach a kid about commitment? And on Slate Plus, we'll be debating if this slower pace of life will stick around after the pandemic, or if we're going to be signing our kids up for all of the activities to make up for lost time. But first, triumphs and fails. Isaac, what do you have for us on your triumphant, hopefully, return to the show?
I have a triumph, I think, but it is not a solo triumph by any means, which is that, you know, vaccination rates are going pretty well here in New York City and COVID rates are going down. And we have sort of in as safe a way as we feel comfortable with, given that Iris is 6 and can't get vaccinated, we're like starting to do normal life stuff again. You know, like we took her to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. We went to a masked party in a friend's backyard and had pizza, and she jumped on a trampoline and stuff like that. And it just feels totally great. It feels so fucking good. And it is a real triumph to be able to do all of that stuff. I feel like a collective one that I hope our listeners are beginning to experience or will experience soon.
Absolutely. I feel a little bit of triumph every day that I'm able to see somebody outside of my home, especially without a mask on.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I say this recording, you know, within an 18-inch by 18-inch space in my bedroom, speaking into this microphone that is hung off a piece of furniture on a boom stand. You know, it's nice to get out.
It is very nice to get out. I absolutely understand.
It's nice to be back kind of real world and getting the kids back out too.
Totally. And you know, it's been gradual because again, it's like she can't get vaccinated, so she can still get sick. And you know, we were so emphatic about wearing a mask everywhere, which was a good thing, but there's a little bit of, you know, germophobia that's resulted, you know, because of that. And so, you know, negotiating how to ease back in a way that's going to make all three of us comfortable has been a process, but it's been working out.
That is great to hear. Isaac, what about you, Elizabeth? Triumph or fail?
So I have a triumph. We have fully moved into our house for the most part. The movers came on Friday and it was like total chaos and just boxes coming into the house and trying to find like a way to feel settled because we've basically been out of the house for over a month now, living in kind of different hotels and traveling here and being with my parents a little bit. So when I was setting up the kids' rooms, like I have a tendency to just like manage everything, like this goes here, put this here. But since they're a little bit older and I wanted them to really feel some ownership over this house. And so I put out like, you know, their furniture was kind of set what was going into the room, but like we put out all the pictures and all the books as we were unpacking and gave them little bags and let them like go shopping within our stuff to set up their rooms. And they made some really like surprising fun decisions. Like Henry chose a bunch of like more artistic prints or art that we have around the house to put in his room. And, you know, as opposed to some of like the more kiddo prints that we had in the past. And they chose like really fun books to stock their own shelves. And it was just a nice way to let them take some ownership, like without the chaos of like us all trying to go to a store or shop online, like that instant gratification. And I don't know, it was just really fun, like watching them set up and then choosing where to hang things and all of that. So we had a good time kind of setting up a little store and and letting them get settled. So their rooms are kind of all set up, and then the rest of the house is still a bit of a disaster. But I think they're feeling settled, and that was kind of the goal.
Your ability to make literally anything a fun family activity is unmatched, Elizabeth.
Well, thanks. I think sometimes when we're moving around and there's so much chaos, I'm trying to think like, well, how can I make this be fun? And who doesn't love shopping, right? But you have to be okay with the crazy decisions, you know, like when your kid wants the framed print that painting that usually goes in the living room. I had to be like, okay, cool.
Right.
Yeah, I was going to say no one claimed your wedding photo for their nightstand. There were any other awkward selections that put you in a weird position?
No, but I mean, it gave me a real glimpse at which children are the most narcissistic, like which took all the pictures of themselves to put in their room and who took kind of other things.
That is wonderful. Well, congratulations on getting settled. That is a triumph all itself. And I'm glad that the kids are having fun participating in moving into your new place. I have a triumph this week as well. I think I may have mentioned that my mother is in town for about a month. I asked her to come. I guess maybe I invited her almost 2 months ago. I was just like, look, I can't do this anymore. I need some help. The Zoom school thing was a complete disaster for me. I just did not have the capacity to work and supervise Naima while she was in virtual class. And some kids are really good at self-management for that stuff. And my child will be doing anything but. She'll have other tabs open. She'll be drawing. She'll just be spaced out. Like, she needs someone there to keep an eye on her. And the teacher was doing the best she could. But, you know, it kind of fell on the adult who was in the house, who was me. And I was usually trying to hide in the closet and, like, make a podcast. So anyway, I asked my mother to come, but then right when she's getting ready to come, we decide to send her back to in-person school. Like, all the parents were vaccinated. Things just kind of changed a little bit. There were only a handful of kids from her class going back. She ends up in in-person school. And so I was kind of like, it's great having grandma here, but, you know, the thing that we'd really needed, like, we didn't actually, you know, like, I didn't have to bring her here this long. I just kind of, you know, moved everybody's schedule around for this or whatever. And so then Naima ended up staying here a couple of days and doing school with my mother watching. And, like, for the first time in the entire school year and every day since then, she has played Roblox with her classmates. Naima has, like, completely rejected all until she got into the physical classroom. Like, she was not doing any sort of social interaction with the other kids. Like, I'd say, why don't you talk to them during lunch? Why don't you play games with them during breaks? I don't like the games they're playing. I don't want to talk to them. And, like, somehow just a few days of, like, having grandma here, holding her hand through class and keeping her focused, she's, like, exchanging phone numbers with kids. Like, she has bonded with her classmates. So that is, I guess, the combination of returning to in-person school where there's, like, three of them in the class and then this. The triumph is that my daughter is, like, socializing with kids again. So as Isaac was saying, this slowly reopening world has a whole lot of triumph for us all right about now.
That's awesome. And your mom is her favorite. So she just needed that boost.
That is true. She is the, like, favorite person in the entire world. She went to her dad's house for a couple days, and then she came back here last night, and I went downstairs to get her, and she gave me a hug, and, oh, hi, mommy, and, you know, very chipper. And, like, when she gets into the apartment, she falls in my mother's arms as if she'd just gotten back from, like, sailing across the world, you know, like, by herself. It was so dramatic. And, like, she, like, stepped back for a minute and they talked, and then she just fell into her arms again. Like, she just couldn't believe that she was really there. So, yeah, she's doing great with her favorite person. So really my triumph was bringing my mother to California. That's all I had to do to make this kid happy.
Hey, you asked for what you need, you know, and it worked. It's amazing.
It absolutely worked. I'm very grateful. Yeah. Before we get into anything else, let's handle some business. Hey, if you haven't already, what are you doing? Subscribe to the show. It won't cost you anything, and the episodes will appear in your podcast app every Thursday. And hey, if you'd like to hear our show without any ads and with a bonus segment on every episode, sign up for Slate Plus. Today, we'll be discussing the parts of our pandemic schedule we'd like to stick around and how things might change for our kids' extracurricular plans when the pandemic comes to an end, if it comes to an end. Here's a sneak peek of what you'll hear if you have Slate Plus.
I really hope that as we're reconsidering things like work and how work works and whether you need to leave your home, whether that meeting could have been an email or whatever, you know, just like we're reexamining that stuff. I hope we'll do something similar with how we treat our children's free time and allowing them to have more of it.
Not only will you get fun segments like that, but you'll even get bonus episodes of shows like Slow Burn and Big Mood, Little Mood, and unlimited reading on the Slate website. As you know, we couldn't do the show without the support of Slate Plus members. It's only a dollar for the first month, and we'd really love for you to join us over there. So to sign up, go to slate.com/momanddadplus. Slate's parenting newsletter is the best place to be notified about all of our parenting content, including Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Care and Feeding, and so much more. It's also a very lovely email in your inbox each week from Dan Kwa. Sign up at slate.com/parenting email. Finally, check us out on Facebook. Just search for Slate Parenting.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Hey, Care and Feeding listeners, it's me, Lucy Lopez. What do ASMR, AI chatbots, and diet culture all have in common? They are all topics explored on Embodied, the Ambie Award-winning weekly podcast from WUNC, North Carolina Public Radio. Each week, acclaimed reporter Anita Rao holds up her journalistic lens to all kinds of things that are sometimes hard to talk about, like sex, health, and relationships. Embodied dives into what some considered taboo to answer important questions about our bodies and our society. Nothing's off limits. Hear from expert guests, including doctors, historians, and psychologists, as they break down everything from the dynamics of egg donation, how couples combat mental health struggles like schizophrenia and OCD, and the profits and pitfalls of the self-care industry. If you need a place to start, I highly recommend checking out their recent episode where Anita interviewed two couples who continued to choose each other after one partner came out as trans. So go ahead, follow Embodied and get new episodes every Friday wherever you listen to podcasts.
Now let's hear our first listener question being read by the fabulous Sasha Leonard.
Hi, Mom and Dad. We have two boys aged 5 and 1. They don't walk. They jump or run. They pretend to be ninjas. They have no off button. And yes, they can be loud when they play. I let my kids be kids and raise them Dutch style, which is my home country. We moved into a condo 3 weeks ago. It's a 2-floor house divided into 4 units. We are on the top floor. 2 units are owned by lovely, quiet, single ladies in their 40s, and the downstairs neighbors are of the boomer generation and have no kids. When moving in, we knocked on all doors and introduced ourselves, but the downstairs neighbors weren't home for several weeks. Then, one late afternoon, we heard noises downstairs and realized that the neighbors were home. My husband and I agreed to go downstairs to introduce ourselves the next morning. Before we could, my husband went for a bike ride in the morning, and when he came back home, our downstairs neighbor opened the front door and said, with no introduction or niceties, "So, you must be the new upstairs neighbors. You have kids. I imagine a little boy. Now we love kids, but..." Followed by him complaining about our kids. He then proceeded to ask questions such as, "Do you have carpets and rugs? Where are they?" This was less than 24 hours after they came home, and he was visibly bothered by his new little neighbors. My husband didn't even know how to react. He tried to be polite, excused himself from the conversation, and came home in utter disbelief. 2 hours later, we left our apartment, and we found a bottle of wine with a note that read, "Welcome to the cloister. We will be leaving for a couple of weeks so your child can be a child as much as he desires. Best to both of you." How do I react? I don't want to start off on the wrong foot, but I also would love to make it clear that they've crossed a boundary and I do not appreciate their passive aggressiveness. P.S. I would love to rub it in that I am actually pregnant with baby number 3 and this is the new normal because the chaos will not die down anytime soon.
So, Elizabeth, I'd love to hear from you first, Mama 3, and also make mention of the fact that this letter comes from someone that you know.
Yes, yes, I do actually know who wrote this letter, and congratulations on the new baby. I'm very excited about that. I guess I feel like overall in this situation, like, yes, the letter and the interaction maybe feels like very passive aggressive, but the overall thing that you want is harmony in this building. Like, you guys are all going to have to live together. I'm just a big fan of the, like, kill them with kindness. I think I would probably have the kids draw them a nice picture and write a little note saying, you know, like, thanks for the welcome. We know our kids are really rambunctious. We're obviously doing what we can, but kids will be kids kind of thing. You are going to have to make some accommodations for other people living in this building and you having children. But I also think that it's okay to have the kids be kids and try to be polite to them. Like, as long as they're not, like, you know, jumping on the floor in a way that is inappropriate, like, you know where those lines are, and making sure that they learn to live in this situation as well. Like, they have to understand that they're part of this community. But I think also, like, if during daytime hours, your kids are being kids and your baby is crying and those sort of things, that's life. And there's nothing you can do about that. But I think resist the urge to, like, go pick a fight with these people, even if their initial reaction to you was not the kindest. I think the best path forward is for you to be kind. I mean, if it were me, I'd probably make a big show of every time I'm coming into the building too, being like, shh, kids, you know, other people live here, even if then once the door shut, we didn't do anything else. Like, I would have this, like, performative aspect, you know, to say kind of like, I understand that I live in this community. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like part of living in an apartment building and raising kids in an apartment building is being considerate to your neighbors and teaching them how to do that. And that's true even if you're Dutch and have sons. And so, you know, like, the downstairs neighbors were obviously themselves inconsiderate about it, a little rude, a little weirdly passive aggressive, this sort of, like, weird preemptive strike before the kids have done anything to be like, well, they better not make any noise. So, like, they're the downstairs neighbors are the reason why this has started off on a bad foot, but it doesn't have to continue on a bad foot. And their interest in not having really loud noise all the time directly above them is a legitimate one. Just like a neighbor who played a loud stereo all the time, you wouldn't necessarily want that while your kids are going to bed, you know? And so I think it's about trying to figure out what the reasonable accommodations are here. Elizabeth, you listed a whole bunch of them. Like, there's a difference between making noise during the day and making noise at night, for example. Mm-hmm. Or you might want to put down rugs because it'll make your downstairs neighbors' lives easier, and you might have found a really nice one. But I have a feeling, given this interaction, that this is probably going to come to a head at some point. They may, in fact, have an unreasonable expectation of silence. And if that's the case, you know, if you've tried to accommodate them in a few ways, you can politely but firmly say, like, hey, these are the things we're doing, but there's not much more we can do about it, and that they have to make their peace with it.
I think that's very fair, Isaac. And I think, letter writer, you have to understand that for these people, by default, you are a nightmare. You are the worst possible neighbors that a pair of boomers do not dream of, especially when they've been in a building with two 40-something women without children. This is a worst-case scenario for them. And that's okay. And that doesn't mean something is wrong with your family or that your kids are bad. It just means that this is not an ideal situation for anyone involved, right? Like, you would prefer to live above people that could let your kids make noise all hours of the night or however you see fit. These people would prefer to live beneath people that are quiet and don't have a bunch of children running around. Of course, you should and will going forward take some steps to be mindful of your neighbors, but also, like, don't forget how annoying this must be for them and that it's okay for them to be annoyed. It's not okay for them to be jerks. It's not okay for them to be mean to you all. They absolutely should be understanding of your situation too, but put yourself in their shoes and try to, I guess, proceed with some empathy. I wouldn't want to live beneath you either. That isn't, you know, I mean, shit.
Yeah.
You got three kids, girl.
Even people with kids,
yes.
Right?
I don't want to live beneath me. Like, I try to keep Naima's steps quiet, but, you know, I was a child of a single mom. There were just two girls in the house, just me and her in the house. And I had a neighbor downstairs that constantly complained about me stomping. So I get it. It's not hard to make noise, and maybe you have creaky floors too, but yeah, it has to suck to live beneath you.
Yeah, I mean, like, I have an upstairs neighbor who paces and smokes cigars, and that's a nightmare. Oh, I mean, gosh. I like him. He's a nice guy. I'm not going to tell him to stop. You know, it's fine. It is just part of the, like, living with other people in an apartment building problem. It's always going to be an issue, and figuring out how to negotiate it, you know, with kindness, but without sacrificing too much of your children's well-being or killing their spirit or whatever. Like, that's a complicated thing, but it's not impossible. Like, it can be done.
Absolutely.
Although also, you know, Dan Coyce is not here, but he did explain in his book, the Polder consensus model of figuring out problems. So I wonder if the solution is to get the entire congressional district that this person lives in together to negotiate an ideal children's volume level. Using a consensus model, and then everyone will just abide by that. Elizabeth, you lived in the Netherlands. What do you think of my solution?
I think the thing in the Netherlands is that everyone would just air their grievance right there, right? Yeah. Like, as the adult said, basically, like, I don't like this living situation. You would be like, well, it is what it is. And then everyone would walk away feeling like they aired their grievance. But I think too, the Netherlands is like values children being children. So although everybody lives on top of each other and in these kind of tight, you know, houses built into the same building, there's a lot of noise and everyone just kind of accepts that so long as that noise doesn't continue in the evening. But they call it like the sounds of life. Like they say, oh, I like this building. There's lots of sounds of life. They don't expect their living place to be quiet.
It is just about calibrating, like, what is a reasonable expectation here for all parties, and then trying to reach that, which can be hard if there's a lot of passive aggression and ill will right off the bat.
Yeah. Do you guys feel like the bottle of wine is a kindness or a passive aggressive? Like, I a little bit wonder if they felt bad about the conversation that they had with her husband or the way that her husband reacted. And so the wine was kind of a way to make up for that.
That is actually how I read it. I read it as them being like, oh, we fucked that up. That did not go well. Let's make a self-deprecating joke about how we don't want to allow their kids to do anything. Do you know what I mean? Like, it felt a bit like textbook people who have trouble saying I'm sorry. And so like what their apologies look like, because they did not actually say I'm sorry, right? But they like came close to acknowledging that they were being a little crazy. And so that's how it read to me.
I agree.
Yeah. And then the letter writer is so angry, she's taking it as like condescending. But I actually think, you know, usually a bottle of wine is an I'm sorry.
unless they're really rich. I mean, that would be like that's a real rich person's way to say fuck yeah. to someone, to be like, here is an 87 Chateau, some, go fuck yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Very exactly. True.
But hopefully, I'm assuming, well, I don't know, because they do have this other place to go to, because I was going to say, well, if they're so rich, they can get another apartment. But we do know that they did essentially do that, at least for a few weeks. So who knows? But I agree. I think that was a nice gesture. They realized that they were not the most pleasant, and it was a natural reaction to this very bad news. And I say this as someone who has seen, I know that when I sat next to you on an airplane when I had a 6-month-old, that was bad news. It's okay, right? It doesn't mean that we didn't belong there, you know, so don't feel bad about it. But, you know, they were blindsided with some bad news and they didn't handle it well. And hopefully they're going to just smooth things over and maybe stay gone all summer. Thank you so much for your letter. We love updates. And since you know Elizabeth, it should be very easy for you to get one to us. So we want to hear how this turns out. What happens when they come back home from their vacay? On to our second listener question, read once again by the marvelous Sasha Leonard.
Hi, I'm looking for a little advice and hopefully some solidarity. I have a 4-year-old daughter who is very smart, even more strong-willed, and also extremely sensitive. This morning, she decided that she no longer liked playing soccer and did not want to go to her game. We are halfway through her first season and have 3 games left. I told her that was not an option and that we're going to keep going to soccer because we made a commitment to the team. If she didn't want to do soccer next season, that's fine, but we are finishing the games that we have left this year. After much protesting, crying, and screaming, we made a deal that she would go to the game, but I wouldn't force her to play. I was hoping she would change her mind when we were there, but of course, she didn't. And we spent the entire hour watching other kids play, which is just how I want to spend my Saturday. I made her sit with the team and apologize to the coach for not playing and told her we were going to the next 2 games. I want to teach her to keep her commitments. My husband feels she is acting like this lesson is not sinking in, but she's 4. I don't really expect her to understand it at this point, but hope our actions teach her something in the long run. What should I do?
What do you think, Isaac?
Oy vey, I feel this letter writer's pain. You know, I feel like I was just there 2 years ago. That balance between, you know, keeping the peace and acknowledging what your child is saying they need on one side, because you don't want to make them miserable, but then also teaching them the right life lesson and modeling the right behavior or whatever. It is just constant, and it's not going to go away anytime soon. We're going through this right now with Iris and practicing her guitar every night, you know? And this is also made more complex by her only being 4. You can't have a really in-depth conversation about what's going on and why she's turned against soccer, and you can't really work it out on that kind of reasonable level. And also, as you yourself note, the odds that she's like gonna, in a very literal way, understand the lesson you're trying to teach her here are probably pretty slim. So I don't mean to punt as the advice giver here, because I feel your pain, but I actually think either decision is fine. I really do. I think you can not go to the other games. You can go to the other games. The reason why I would lean towards the second is that you've told your daughter that that's what you're going to do. So, you know, you want to make it clear that if you tell her that something's going to happen or there's going to be a consequence, that it's really going to happen. But beyond that, I think it's kind of fine. It's not like if you give in on this one thing, she's never going to hold a commitment again. You know what I mean? Am I being too wishy-washy? What do y'all think?
So I guess I'm curious why she wants to quit, because with 4-year-olds, it seems to me like the answer could be as much as like they thought they were going to play iPad instead, right? Or like somebody said something to them that they didn't like an easy fix, or they don't like the uniform or their socks. So asking right. First, like establishing what the issue is. I also think it is okay to not push the commitment thing. Like, to me, a commitment is more about what happens to the teammates and the coach if you don't show up, not showing up and phoning it in. And so this lesson of like, we just show up and we sit there, I don't know is the lesson that you necessarily want to teach your four-year-old. Like, what you've told her is basically you tried something new, and maybe let's say you've established that she like honestly hates soccer, right? But that now says, if you try something new and you hate it, you have to go anyway. And I think it really discourages this idea of trying things new and finding things that we don't like, and also excusing ourselves from doing things that we don't like or that we don't find pleasure in, that are pleasure activities. I think the lesson here is teaching how to exit those things, right? So absolutely, one, talk to the coach, because if you make this child go and now you are having the coach supervise them sitting there, but they don't want to play, like, you've put that burden on somebody else instead of on yourself. And I think too, talk about like, what are the ramifications? Like, if you don't go, is there a chance that they can't play? They have to forfeit? Like, that situation for commitment is very different. If that's the case, then yes, we have to show up, because if we don't go, these other children don't get to play. Right? That is the type of commitment we're trying to teach. But if you're one of, you know, 20 kids on this team, and you being there or not being there makes zero difference, I think it's okay to say, all right, we are going to go together, tell the coach that we are not going to play anymore, and this is why, and this is how we exit, in a way that makes sure that kind of all those things that we were committed to are covered. Like, did we have any other responsibilities? Do we need to turn the uniforms back in? Like, whatever those are, doing those and closing that chapter. I just find that, like, I grew up in like a, we are committed to this and we're going to do this. And I feel like I still face some of those ramifications and like, do I really want to try this? Because what if I don't like it? And then I'm committed to this, you know, long-term thing. Or even as adults, like exiting, not work responsibilities, but exiting these leisure activities or friendships or things like that, because we've somehow made this commitment. I think it's okay to teach your kid, like, you didn't like this, you tried, thanks, here's how to get out of this in the right way. But also they're four. So, you know, four-year-olds are notoriously stubborn. And by the time you hear this, they may have decided that soccer is their most favorite thing in the whole wide world.
I agree with so much of that, Elizabeth. I also am a little bothered by the idea of teaching a kid that, like, hey, if you try something new and you find that you don't like it, you just have to keep doing it. And that's what happens when you, that's what you get for trying. So next time, don't take an interest in something if you don't want to risk not liking it. You know, I am also curious to know, like, what sort of conversations were you having about soccer after the first four games, right? Like, was it that she was just kind of tolerating it? Did she go from enthusiastic to passive to, I really don't like this? As Elizabeth said, four-year-olds' tastes and manners and ideas change super quickly. So she could have a change of heart after one really fun game. But I think that, one, you should do a little bit more of a check-in to see, like, what she's been feeling about soccer all along. Because it could have been that she never liked it and for some reason didn't feel like she could tell you that. You know, like, yeah. She might have reached her boiling point. Like, this could have been just too much, where it's like, I just cannot keep this charade up any longer. I'm done with this sport. And four is old enough to know that something is really not enjoyable to you. You know, I mean, I don't think that you have this vested interest in, you know, encouraging her to continue soccer because it's this important family tradition or something that you are really, you know, passionate about, but just that this was something she was doing and she doesn't really seem to like it. So I would say, I guess I haven't answered the question. I'm like, I'm hearing everything that everyone said. One, do not make her go to the games and watch. That sucks for everybody. You're just punishing yourself. And it doesn't really make much of a point, as much as it just kind of ruins everyone's Saturday. But I would say, you know, agree to her that you'll, if she's unclear when you talk to her about it, like if she gives you a very passionate, like, I've never liked it and this is why, and I'm clear, you know, let it go, move on, cut your losses. You know, if she shows a glimmer of, you know, maybe I was just kind of having a crappy day, or I had a crappy experience in soccer, or, you know, maybe there's one person there who said something to her the last time she was, you know, before all this happened, and that's what set her off. But get to the root of her beef with soccer and proceed from there. But I think it's totally fine to let her walk away from the team. They will make it without her. They'll be fine.
But it's also fine that it's just 2 more weeks. Like, it's 2 more weeks. Who cares? Just go for 2 more weeks. Like, I mean, it's not like she's going to enroll her in soccer next semester either way or whatever. Like, I don't actually understand why it's such a big deal to go for 2 weeks. But I have another question, which is, why are they playing games at 4? Like, what soccer is this? Because, like, Iris did soccer. I'm going to put that in heavy quotes, because their soccer was like, we're stacking these cones because the mayor told us we had to build buildings. And then it was like, oh no, there are cannonballs coming to knock down the buildings. And then they would kick the balls into the cones. And then isn't that what soccer is when you're 4? I'm a little confused. It may be that this soccer program sucks. That's the other thing.
Yeah. Like, it's too much for a 4-year-old, right? Like, like, who wants to stand around on the field and, like, hope the ball comes? Or that other thing that happens, which is just, like, the huddle of children around the ball, right? Like, that's not fun either.
Yeah, I had a friend who was like, because his kid was also in this soccer thing with Iris. And he was like, I want to go to this other one because they're, like, scrimmaging more. And I was like, they're 3.5.
What the hell?
Like, they don't need to scrimmage at 3.5. They just need to, like, run around some cones, get some energy out. Never touch the ball with your hands.
Yeah. 4 should be, like, establishing general rules of the game. Like, there's a ball, there are 2 goals, and we use our feet.
This sounds so much more stressful than it should be for anything involving a 4-year-old, which is my reason for being like, fuck it, just run away. But 2 weeks is not a long time. Like, she technically should be able to do this if this doesn't absolutely make her miserable. But if it's going to make you absolutely miserable to have to hear her scream about it, I still say cut your losses.
This is one of the problems with disciplining kids that age, is that the parents actually bear the brunt of whatever the disciplinary thing is. Like, the blowback is always much bigger. Whatever consequences you impose actually hurt the parents more.
Literally the worst.
Parents, it is okay to determine that the thing you said in the heat of the moment was not the best decision. Like, you shouldn't be saddled with your bad punishment either. I just think, yes, it's only 2 weeks, but it is like, I don't know, are these games an hour? Are they, you know, like, what is the drive like? Do you have other kids? Like, all of that should be taken into account, you know? But, you know, if they don't finish the season, they don't get to go to the end of the year shindig or whatever either. That is the consequence. Yeah.
Is there regulation extra play at the end for all the time that the refs took to?
I think this will be your last grand opening, grand closing.
It also just occurred to me that there is a difference in terms of teaching your child about commitment, which I do think can be a valuable thing. But, like, there is a difference between whether or not your child ever asked to do soccer in the first place. Mm-hmm. If this is a thing that you signed them up for, they never committed to doing it. And so there is no lesson to be taught in forcing them to continue to do it. You thought they would like it, and then you're making them do it more. If it is, like, just to give an example from my own life, like Iris and her playing the guitar, which she actually enjoys. She just doesn't like the practicing part of it. She likes playing it. She likes the lessons. She likes the recitals. So it's just figuring that part out. But she specifically asked us if we would sign her up for guitar lessons because she wanted to learn how to play. You know, and that is a different thing. That is a different thing in terms of the kid and their agency and what they're agreeing to, that I think creates different obligations than if it's something you signed them up for because you thought they'd like it.
But I also think, like, 4-year-olds can't even commit to lunch. Like, they ask you for something and then you put it on their plate and they're like, I didn't order this. Like, they...
I don't actually want this is a thing that I've heard many times in my life.
But I agree with you. I think, like, the agency over this I think is the important lesson, is like, even if, like, if Iris came to you and said, I don't like this anymore, this is no longer fun, right? You'd have a conversation with her. And if it turned out that it was, you would together figure out where that exit point is, right? And I guess that is what I think the conversation at this point has to be, also with the knowledge that they're four. So like, if in fact you have the conversation and the problem is soccer, like the problem is not anything else, it is the playing of the game of soccer and the way it is played at this kind of practice, I think it's okay to say, you know, thanks for trying. And I, you know, I'm sorry you didn't like this. Here's how we exit this in a way that doesn't leave anyone hanging.
I love that. I think, letter writer, you've got a lot of great stuff to think about in this very crucial decision about whether this four-year-old will continue her professional sports career. Yeah. And we look forward to hearing what you all decide, ultimately. Please feel free to send us an update. And fellow listeners, if you have a parenting conundrum that you would like for us to consider, send us a note at momanddad@slate.com, or you can do what this listener did and you can post it to the Slate Parenting Group on Facebook. Before we get out of here, of course, we have recommendations. Elizabeth, what do you have for us this week?
I have a simple recommendation. June 1st is the traditional, like, kind of start of summer reading, which we love in this house. In fact, my 9-year-old woke up and was like, it's summer reading. Like, how do I log my book? So go sign your kids up for summer reading. They have them at, you know, all the libraries, but also bookstores. There's even like old school Pizza Hut Book It is back for the summer. So go sign up for those and sign yourself up too, because it's always good to just have some motivation to try some new books and read some different things and be reading with your kids. So I'm recommending summer reading.
Love that. And Book It is back? Are you kidding me? I'm signing up right now.
Book It is back. I mean, it's always been available for homeschoolers, but they are doing it for summer reading this summer too. So you read your 20 minutes a day for 20 days and you can earn a personal pan pizza. Just like, I don't know, Jamila, did you grow up with that?
I grew up with that. So, you know. Absolutely. 100. That was a very, very special part of my childhood. As was sitting in Pizza
Hut. I agree. It's like the best thing to share with the kids. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Great, Elizabeth. What do you have, Isaac?
I have a reading-related one, too. They've been around for a long time, and they're well-known, so maybe many of our listeners will roll their eyes, but I'm going to recommend the Bob books, the early reading book sets that help your kids learn how to read. Iris knows the basics of how to read, but is very reluctant to claim that she is a reader or knows how to read or to kind of own that, because she's not, like, amazing at it. I asked her teachers, you know, what can we do? Like, you know, she'll clearly be reading something and I'll ask her to read it out loud to me and she'll say, I don't know how to read. They said, get these Bob books. And you know what? It totally worked. They come in boxed sets of 12, you know, short books. They're like 5 sentences long with really crude drawings. Each one of them is doing some sound thing, you know, short vowels, long vowels, hard consonants, whatever, sight words, things like that. And they're really fun and they're not hard and the kids get an immediate sense of accomplishment from them. So I highly recommend, if you have like a kindergartner who's putting reading together, that you do a little extra practice with these old Bob books.
Very nice. Sounds super helpful. So I also have a reading related recommendation, but it's for the grown-ups. I suck at self-promotion. I always have. I hate it. And if you've ever seen me post anything that I've done online, it was done with the deepest of shame. I blush in real life. Black girls blush. It's terrible, but I do need to let people know about stuff that I'm publishing, and these things were about parenting, so I figured I should share them with you. So one, I do contribute to the Karen Feeding Parenting column every week. In the show notes this week, I have my column from last week. Hopefully you're reading all things Karen Feeding. There's a wonderful roster of contributors that I'm very honored to be a part of. And I recently published a piece with Parents Magazine about my daughter seeing herself in Black role models and what that means to her. And one last month, or actually in April, on April 20th, for 420 about weed and motherhood, Black single motherhood in particular. And I'm proud of them. So go on and rate them if you haven't. Thank you so much if you have. We've got a link to them in the show notes.
You should be proud of them. I love that you're promoting this.
Thank you. I know Elizabeth always cheers me on so much. I really appreciate that because I really do. It's hard for me to share. I know it's weird, especially when you've had something like you've gone through the trouble of getting something published. And it's like, oh, I have to tell people to go read it. That part is embarrassing. But
it is so mortifying to have to do it. It's so, you know.
Every single time. But nevertheless, she persisted.
That's how much you love our listeners, that you're willing to be a little embarrassed to share these wonderful pieces. So everyone, go click those links.
Oh, thank you. And with that is our show. Thank you for listening. And one last time, if you have a question for us, send us an email to momanddadatslate.com or post it to the Slate Parenting Facebook group, which you can find by just searching for Slate Parenting. Mom and Dad Are Fighting is produced by Rosemary Belson. For Elizabeth Newcamp and Isaac Butler, I'm Jamila Lemieux.